Hey, everybody, I'm Kai Rizdahl.
I'm Molly Wood.
Welcome
to Make Me Smart. I'm right here. Every week, we are connecting the dots on all things tech, economics, and culture. We talk to experts and we talk to you guys because none of us is as smart as all of us. What a good thing. We should put that on a t-shirt or something.
We should. Don't give it away. Don't give it away. I guess I just gave it away. All right. Anyway, the government is back open, at least until the Ides of February, as it were, the 15th of February, which gives Congress plus or minus 3 weeks to sort itself out. Also gives the White House 3 weeks to sort itself out. Hello. And come to some kind of agreement on the budget. Whether we can get there or not is a whole different thing. And if they don't, square one is where we are.
I feel like Congress and the White House can totally fix all of these things in 3 weeks, don't
you? Are you high?
Don't we all think so?
You're high.
I know. That's why we're basically doing this episode right now, because no one thinks that in 3 short weeks, okay, this is all going to get fixed. So we thought, what a good, I mean, I still might be high, but in this case, I'm right. Even with, I don't know, we're somehow like way too delighted that the government is back open. I'm not
sure. Which is insane.
But even with this short reopening, exactly, because the effects are still ongoing, where we've had, you know, whatever, 3 or 4 shutdowns in the past 20 years. It is increasingly common, and we wondered why. So we're going to start with a view from the ground. Producer Shara Morris called up Brandon Grimmett. He is, you know, for step one, he's Associate Provost for Career and Professional Development at Loyola Marymount University in LA. He helps students get internships and jobs and says that, you know, up to 5% of their undergrads go into government work. Many of them get on to that path because federal agencies come to campus to recruit. And normally the career fair at Loyola Marymount would be full of government reps from the State Department, the FBI, Homeland Security. But Brandon says this year things are very different.
We've seen none of that recruiting for those agencies this year at all. And there's been both a decrease in job postings for those agencies and also a pretty rapid decrease in their on-campus presence. So despite multiple invitations to those agencies to recruit on our campus, we've heard nothing from them.
Which stinks for the kids, right? I mean, that's the name of that game. Right? Stinks for the kids.
It stinks for the kids, but also, depending on how that recruiting goes on over time, it stinks for those agencies, too, if those kids go on to get other jobs.
Exactly. Some of those students were supposed to start agency internships this January, as in this month. Start dates obviously have been pushed back a month or more. Some have submitted their applications for jobs or internships, but they have no idea about what's going on.
Many of these jobs, especially with agencies like the State Department, FBI, CIA, and others, require several years up to several years of background checks and security clearances that must go through. And so the timing of when students begin that process or take things like the Foreign Service exam, many of them have been working and spending time and effort and money to take these exams and tests, and all to know that either their start date has been delayed or been postponed, or in some cases they have yet to hear back from those agencies. I would say it's disheartening for a lot of our students. You know, many of them have been aiming for these jobs for most of their college career and have done research on the opportunities, done some networking and outreach to alumni that work in those fields. To have that rug pulled out from underneath them now is a little bit of a morale break for them.
Yeah.
He is advising students to look for government jobs at the state and local level instead, which I would imagine they would also think is a bummer if they had their, you know, heart set on Quantico. He says this experience is a reality check about the public sector.
So I would say that what we're trying to do is guide our students toward just as meaningful career options and make sure that they know that this is actually part of the risk of working for the federal government. And there's other kinds of risk out there in terms of hiring freezes that were already in place before the shutdown.
So this is like an additional risk to working for the federal government, right? Because when you work for the federal government, you are not necessarily paid in accordance with your education and your training as people are paid in the private sector. Also, you are a target for politicians and have been forever. And generally, and this is a broad statement, so work with me here because I'm a former government guy. You are the subject of some disdain by the American population, right, who thinks of you as a bureaucrat and whatnot. I actually don't understand why people now are thinking about going into the government when you have this kind of dysfunction and devaluation of your profession, right? Because if you are a lawyer for the EPA, you are trained and educated and professionally proficient in a very specific area of the law that matters in the policymaking body where it can be applied. And you know, I just think it stinks that that's kind of the deal, you know?
It does. And it is long-term, you know, and that's part of why we want to have this conversation today. Long-term, it's a real threat to the level of function that our government can continue to operate at. Like, if we don't get the best and brightest, and recruiting for the federal government, for all of the reasons that Kai just said, has been difficult for a long time and is only getting harder. And if you don't have the best and the brightest and you're facing down national security issues ranging from, you know, climate change to cybersecurity, for example, just in my beat alone, this conversation is very relevant. And if you're getting kind of the people who you're, you know, much like teaching at a public school, you're either getting true believers or people who are pretty demoralized and have kind of given up.
So here's what we're going to do today. We're going to talk actually about why and how the shutdown happens and how the idea of shutting down the government of the United States in whatever percentage of shutdown you choose is even a part of the political calculation in this country or weaponry. Right? Because that's what it's become. So we have called Roy Myers. He's a professor of political science at the University of Maryland, Baltimore campus. Baltimore County, right? I think. Professor, right? You there?
Yeah. Hi.
So look, do this for us, would you? Is there a foundational moment when shutdowns became a political weapon?
Yes, there are actually two related moments. The first was in 1980 when President Carter's Attorney General, Ben Civiletti, issued an opinion that when there's a so-called funding gap, that is when the regular appropriation bill isn't passed, that the agencies have to cease operations. Hmm. Before that, when there are funding gaps, the agencies just kind of slowed down a bit. They didn't close up shop. And then in 95 and 96, there were two long shutdowns that were precipitated by Newt Gingrich and the House Republicans. They had just won a big election victory in 1994.
Yeah.
And in part of their so-called contract with America, they said they were going to shrink government by reducing spending. So they were trying to get President Clinton to go along with that, and he didn't want to. So in the first instance, they passed a bill which he vetoed, a continuing resolution which he vetoed. And then the second instance, they just decided not to pass a continuing resolution and the government shut down for 21 days.
I was there. I remember that. I was actually in Foreign Service training, and this is a terrible thing to say, but it was literally a 3-week vacation because I was young and single and wasn't worried about money. But I cannot imagine what it was like for some 45-year-old woman who had to make a mortgage and a car payment and all of that other stuff and feed her kids and all of that stuff. And it's kind of amazing to think that we just came out of a 35-day shutdown. And everybody in Washington said that was okay. Mm-hmm. I don't get it. But anyway.
No, but I feel like that is kind of the relevant question. Nobody liked this, right? These shutdowns, even back then, they hurt the images of the politicians involved. Voters obviously hate them. They do real damage to individuals and to GDP. Why, Professor, help us here. Why do they keep happening?
Well, you know, memories sometimes are short, and then sometimes there's replacement of people who should have learned their lesson by people that never learned it in the first place. So if you go back to 95, 96, the year after, there was actually an agreement. President Clinton and Newt Gingrich negotiated in private, and they adopted some changes that, in particular, reduced the rate of growth for Medicare spending. And then, you know, actually there weren't any shutdowns until 2013. Mm-hmm. So they actually learned their lesson. Mm-hmm. You know, Kai was absolutely right. A lot of people thought it was an absolutely stupid decision to shut down the government in 95, 96. And I agree, it was crazy. But in 2013, there was another shutdown. And it was driven by about the same group of people in the Republican Party, the conservative wing. And most of those people have less interest in having a large functioning government than the people that voted against the shutdown.
Yeah, so we'll get to that part of it in a minute, right? Because there are some bills now being offered to prevent shutdowns in the future, one from a Republican and one from a Democrat. And so we'll talk about those in a minute. But let me ask you the history major question here, if I might. If James Madison came back to life today and plopped himself down in the middle of Washington, D.C., in the middle of a shutdown, would he think that this was an intended consequence of the way those guys wrote the Constitution, or is it some kind of indicator of a broken system?
Oh, definitely the latter. And I do have a picture of James Madison on my office wall. So I think he was brilliant and deserved a lot of praise for designing our government as it is. But what he said in the Federalist Papers, and at least some of the Federalist Papers, is that we depend on representative government to bring representatives and in Congress and the president together, and then to deliberate, to take public opinion and improve on it. And that's what is not happening now. When there's a shutdown, there's a refusal to listen to each other's side. And in particular, in President Trump's case, the decision to say it's my way or the highway. And that kind of intransigence is not something that can work well in a system of government where you have separate institutions that share powers and need to cooperate.
So in a way, does it seem like the pace of shutdowns itself represents then that polarization that, you know, we had that long break from 95, 96 to 2013. Now it feels common. It feels like heaven help us, a built-in part of our budgeting process. Is it actually a function of partisanship?
Yes, to some large degree, but also splits within parties. So the fact that the Republican Party couldn't agree on its own position in 2013 was one of the reasons why the 2013 shutdown occurred, and one reason why they've had a hard time reaching agreement on budget bills recently. But I think you have to go back to the budget deal that was agreed to in 2011. Remember the super committee and the requirements to try and reach across the aisle compromises, which failed. And that led to the imposition of ceilings on discretionary spending that we call the caps. And they're pretty stringent. So now we're stuck with these ceilings, and every 2 years, Congress and the president have to negotiate about replacing them, that is, increasing them. And in fact, we have that kind of fight coming up, assuming that this wall shutdown problem is resolved. In addition, the debt ceiling, which is temporarily suspended till March 1st, on March 2nd, unless we raise the debt ceiling or the Secretary of Treasury is allowed by President Trump to use what are called extraordinary measures, which are, in effect, gimmicks for borrowing, but not calling it borrowing, then we're going to have an even greater problem because, you know, the idea that the U.S. government would default on its debt is absolutely insane.
Well, but wait. I mean, we have a guy in the White House now, right? The president of the United States, who, when he was running, said, I can absolutely renegotiate government debt and get a better deal.
And I would have to go back to the Wall Street Journal to see how the bond market reacted that day. But I think they probably should have been worried to even hear a president say something as crazy as that.
Well, okay. I'm just gonna lean into that segue a little bit and ask you this question: how dependent are we for the proper functioning of this government on rational actors? Because it seems like we're a little out of balance.
No, I agree. Now, some political scientists would say it's rational to try and just hurt your opponent as much as possible in the expectation that will help you in the next election. But I think what we're seeing now is an excess of that. That is, trying to repeatedly set up situations where you blame the other side is a good way to actually ruin your own reputation. And that's what's happened to President Trump in this most recent shutdown and to some of the Republicans that went along with him, even though they, I think in many cases, would have preferred not to have the shutdown in the first place and wanted President Trump to end it a lot earlier than he did.
Yes, I hear you on that. But is it also the natural conclusion of a pattern of behavior that did start in 1995? I mean, you mentioned that there is there's an element of this that is in fact part of the political philosophy of the Republican Party, which is maybe we don't need so much government. Like you could argue that Carter's attorney general was issuing what he thought was a legal opinion. Like he said,
very much so.
To me, this is a legal black and white. And then it became a philosophy, which is that maybe if all this government goes away, that's not a bad thing.
Yes, I agree with you in general, but let me talk about that in a second, but it's also the case that last year, at the beginning of 2018, the Democrats in the Senate produced a shutdown, but only for a couple of days. They were insisting that protection for the Dreamers, for the DACA revision, be ended. And, you know, Senator Schumer and his colleagues came to their senses a little faster than President Trump did. So, but in general, I think you're right. I mean, if you look at what's happened to selected agencies in the federal government, they are being intentionally hollowed out. Starting at the first day of the Trump administration.
Right.
But then if you look at the shutdown and the people who were allowed to keep working, the people who review permit applications for doing oil and gas leases were viewed as, quote, essential, unquote. So there's, I believe that there were certainly violations of the law by the Office of Management and Budget Agencies in not paying attention to the law that Attorney General Civiletti was basing his decision on, which is called the Anti-Deficiency Act.
Right.
But it's going to be hard for people to challenge those decisions legally to get standing in court. I do believe, though, we're going to see major oversight hearings on this very issue.
So, look, there are, I'm sure, going to be oversight hearings. I think you're right. But there are also now at least two bills being proposed, one by Rob Portman, Republican of Ohio, the other one by Mark Warner, Democrat of Virginia. Warner wants to not let the executive office of the president and the legislative branch get paid if there's a shutdown, but everything else has to stay open. Portman's is the interesting one, though, because what he does is he says, okay, if there's a lapse in funding, everybody stays open except you get 1% less money for 120 days. And then if it's still shut down, you get another 1% less money. And then after 90 days after that, it's another 1% money. And that is a way, as you were talking about a minute ago, of making the government smaller. And there's no incentive then for Republicans who want smaller government to energize and try to get the government back open because they're getting what they want in the process of this bill.
Mm. Yeah, actually, you know, I looked at the Portman bill yesterday, the one he just recently reintroduced, and he changed the language somewhat in that 1% cut doesn't occur until after the first 120 days in a fiscal year.
Right.
Which I think is a signal that he's sending that he's willing to compromise with Democrats.
Huh.
So now, you're absolutely right, because what we call the reversionary level, the spending rate would, that's jargon. The spending rate would be if a regular appropriation bill wasn't passed, if it's going to be automatically cut. Yes, people that would like to cut government have an added incentive to not take any action.
Right.
So now, actually, there's some pretty strong similarities between the Portman and the Warner bills, and I wouldn't be surprised if we see some legislative action and adoption of it in the next couple months.
Huh. That's fascinating.
Really? You think there is a possibility that this tool will be taken out of the box, if you will?
Yeah. You know, there's been one very undercovered story last year, and there was a special committee set up in Congress called the Joint Select Committee on Budget and Appropriations Process Reform. So it had 8 Democrats, 8 Republicans, equal senators, equal members of the House of Representatives, and they didn't produce anything. They came close to reaching agreement on some minor changes, and then it all fell apart because of the partisan distrust. Hmm. But the staff of that special committee are still interested, and some of the members of the committee are still interested in doing something. And I think this is a perfect opportunity for them because they've just embarrassed themselves with the longest shutdown possible. And it seems to make a lot of sense to come up with the automatic continuing resolution procedure and solve this problem once and for all. You know, the comment I've made before is that this should be the 3 strikes and it's out and you're out for government shutdowns. 95, 96, 2013, and then 2018, 2019. Mm. Why do we want to repeat it?
Roy Myers is a professor of political science, University of Maryland, Baltimore County. Thanks so much for your time, sir. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks so much, sir. Huh. I mean, it does come down to how much anybody feels shame at this point,
right,
I guess.
Right.
Tell us more about how the shutdown and the threat of another one has been affecting you. We'd love to hear it. Email us at makemesmart@marketplace.org. Don't be surprised if Shara Morris emails you right back and asks if she can call you up to record your story, because that is how it works. So please keep it coming. We're going to take a quick breather and then come back with our fixations.
We're back.
We're back.
Back is where we are.
It was brief.
It was
a breather. I breathed.
That's what we said. You breathed. All right. You've got two. I've got one. That means you go first.
I would like to just say now, too, that I'm just adding a third one, which is I would love to I'd love to do a show about PG&E. Man, I cannot get enough. Oh,
well, for those not in California, Pacific Gas and Electric, the big utility out here, has gone bankrupt over liabilities from the wildfires out here last couple of years. It's a big, fat, hairy mess. And now they're in Chapter 11 for the second time in like 25 years. Uh-huh. I like the way you sneak them in. You're like, oh, I'm just going to talk about these.
Did you? It's because... My brain is like a jumping bean, basically.
Oh, that's
did
that's
you read the Wall Street Journal op-ed by Mark Zuckerberg last week?
No, I read Kara Swisher's interpretation of it.
Well, it was really interesting. And it's called The Facts About Facebook.
Yep.
And it, you know, it essentially, I urge you to read both of those.
All right.
But it, you know, it essentially says like, this is what our business model is, and this is how we use your ads, and we're just, I'm trying to come out and explain it as clearly as I can, because I know that you love our free service and these very targeted ads that are so relevant for you. And throughout promises, it says, look, I know that people are concerned that this model is very complex, and in an ordinary transaction, it's really straightforward what happens. And but you should know, and this is repeated many times, you should know that you have transparency and control. You have control over what information we use to show you ads, and you can block any advertiser from reaching you. You can find out why you're seeing an ad, I'm reading now, and change your preferences to get ads you're interested in. And you can use our transparency tools to see every different ad an advertiser is showing to anyone else. Now, I will tell you that I consider myself a relatively intelligent person. And I have tried to use these tools to essentially no avail. They are complicated. They are multifaceted. They take a lot of clicking. I think that you have to individually remove each advertiser who is advertising to you in order to sort of clear the slate. Like, this is not, these are not. And I would urge you, please email me. Do you or do you not think that these tools that Facebook has provided you so that you know exactly what's happening on their platform with respect to advertising, do you or do you not think that those are transparent, easy to use, and that you have full control over what's happening on that platform? And if you do think that, or don't, I'm spooling up here.
No, that's fine. Go ahead.
Please, I was just interject.
Do I have to email you, or can I just say now what I think about this?
Yeah, go for it. What do you think?
I do not think Facebook is transparent, Ms. Wood. That's it.
I agree. And it's so funny because here's this whole big op-ed that says we're really transparent and you can see exactly what's happening. But if you are an outside party, because this coincided almost directly, just a few days later, ProPublica put out a piece saying, well, that's so funny because ProPublica, Mozilla, and an outlet called Who Targets Me, who are dedicated to helping you determine who exactly is targeting you, created tools to engage in just this kind of transparency on the Facebook platform, and Facebook has blocked them within the last month. So again, like, the answer to what's happening on Facebook is trust Facebook. And anybody else who's trying to gather information about a platform that could be very transparent and open to letting us know what's happening, that's blocked.
Oh, I have a question.
Yes.
Okay. What do you think it would take for Facebook to regain the trust of the American people and those of us who are no longer using that platform?
I mean, ironically, what it would take is peer review, right? Like, engage in the scientific method. What really enraged me, what has sparked this rant, is the fact that you cannot tell, like, don't pee on my shoes and tell me it's raining. You can't tell me that you're a transparent platform committed to transparency that's so transparent if you block tools that increase transparency. Bring in, like, let third parties audit your system. Let other tools cross-check what you claim that you're doing. If you block any effort to verify what you're telling me, and yet you're still trying to tell me it's raining, I don't believe you. It's pee on my shoe.
This is now the It's Pee on My Shoe episode. And if all y'all don't title it that in the podcast feed, you have no guts. Zero.
It's Pee on My Shoe. The ever classy make me smart.
That's right. That's right.
Not raining.
Man. Anything you didn't mention that you would like me to ask you about, Ms. Wood?
I'm good. I can
okay.
start now.
All right.
Your
Very
turn.
Good. Okay. I would just, we're going to make a little pivot here. I will be more brief than
Thanks
my
for
colleague,
indulging me.
Molly Wood. Uh-huh. Yes, of course. It's look, it's your podcast too, pal.
I
sort of can't get over Howard Schultz. I sort of can't get over the fact that, number one, the hubris. And look, I understand that the last CEO to run for president actually won. But the idea that because he ran a company incredibly successfully, he understands and can manage American politics, I think is gobsmacking. And I also think, by the way, that he reads the – and look, I'm certainly no political practitioner here, but I think he's reading the American electorate the wrong way. And I think what will wind up happening, as do all the experts, by the way, is that he's going to split the left, right? He says, no, I'm going to run as an independent centrist. He's going to split the Democrats. And it will redound to the president's benefit. And I think it's going to be very interesting to see what happens as he is pressed for more specifics on his ideas, because now all he's saying is, ooh, debt is bad. Well, okay, let's talk about that. He's also saying, well, the only way to fix things in this country is comprehensive tax reform, which means what exactly, sir? So I think it's going to be really interesting to see what happens as he gets pressed more on his platform, and then how the slice of the American public that is somewhat in the middle this time, right? Because you got the Trump hardcore, you got the left hardcore, and then you've got a large body in the middle that he's in theory going after, except the catch is that that large body in the middle that independents go after, they don't actually stay independent. They gravitate, theorists will tell you, to one pole or the other, politically speaking. So anyway, I can't stop thinking about Howard Schultz and what it's going to mean if he actually does a third party run in 2020. That's what I got.
I agree.
Yeah.
God save us from the billionaires who think that for whatever reason, this time they will make it different through sheer force. It's like it's sort of like Elon Musk trying to launch that whole project to try to figure out whether we're living in a computer simulation, which I know that this doesn't feel like an exact analogy
either, ever.
But it is like the hubris of thinking that someone has coded our entire universe and created it as a simulation, but you alone are smart enough to like puncture the bubble and figure it out and reach the overlords is like exactly the kind of hubris that says, no, no, this time the independent thing is totally going to work. Ross Perot had it all wrong.
Right.
I'm completely different from him.
Ross Perot, Jill Stein, John Anderson in 1980, although he didn't hurt Carter that much. Anyway, so I don't know what to tell you.
I'm with you.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm not going to spool up again because I'm tired, but I agree.
It must be draining to be spooled like that. It must be draining. All right. We haven't said this in a while on this pod, but get a hold of us. MakeMeSmart@Marketplace.org. You can hit me and Molly up on Twitter. She's at Molly Wood. I'm at Kai Rizdahl. Let us know what you think about Howard Schultz or pee on your shoes or anything you like. There we go.
Or shutdowns, any of it.
Yes.
And now it is, in fact, time. On that note, it is time for a representative sampling of the kinds of things you send us. Time for your fixations.
Hi, Kai and Molly.
This is Brent in Detroit.
This is Rebecca from Baltimore.
It was great to hear comments on my question about GDPR.
I wanted to put in my vote.
I want to discuss a slightly different but maybe related thing.
Okay.
This is, I would say, related. On the government shutdown, Lillian Reed writes, I wondered how 50,000 coal mining jobs can have so much more political leverage than 800,000 government worker jobs. Is it just because the coal industry has a lobby and federal workers don't?
Well, kind of. I mean, it sort of goes to what we were talking about with Roy Myers. So here's the deal. Number one, government service has been devalued over the decades. That's number one. Number two is the president of the United States used those coal workers as a way to get elected.
Mm-hmm.
And he promised that he would bring back coal jobs and he would rebuild the American coal industry. And he made them into a political prop, which got them the press and the political attention. And the workers, 800,000 of them, who didn't get paid for 35 days, had no such, shall we say, presence in the debate. Mm-hmm. You never once heard the president talk about him. Not one time.
The few times it was acknowledged, it was, you know, I don't know, make changes and get by. I would say these 800,000 jobs have just as much weight as any party gives them, but it's not a job for job exchange because the coal mining jobs are just as much a metaphor
You bet.
As they are a reality.
Right. We actually got one listener, E. Bruce Lawson. He's from Florida. He told us how the shutdown affected him and his community. Here you go.
We had a federal employee as a tenant call today. They are not expecting to be able to pay next month's rent because of the shutdown. The tenant has never been late, so I am waiving any late fee, and they will pay me when they are being paid again. Essentially, as an American business person, I am now having to effectively give the U.S. federal government a bailout because they can't pay their employees. And yes, they are an essential employee and having to work through the shutdown to help keep us all safe.
So, Mr. Lawson, drop us a line. Let us know whether you got paid, right? I mean, we're you know, 5 days past the shutdown now. Let us know. Make me smart. Marketplace.org.
Wow. You guys have been killing it, as always, with your listener responses. We got the question of whether higher ed is worth it touches a lot of nerve. It's really, really interesting how much response there's been and how surprisingly emotional the question, I guess it's not surprising, how emotional the question of education is and its value. Lindy Miller from Georgia ran for statewide office in the 2018 midterm. She said she met a lot of people, as did almost every politician, I think, on the campaign trail who were struggling to find jobs and pay bills. But that does not mean that she wants to dismiss a four-year college experience altogether.
Hey, y'all. The value of college for many people goes well beyond the degree one obtains. Not once in your show did you mention the networks people form, the diversity of experiences or exposure they may have versus heading into the workforce and seeing the same people day after day in a job or in their life, or the opportunities that exist on campuses to engage in the broader world. Is this worth the debt? I can't answer that for anyone else, but I can say that we're headed to a dark, dark place if only the very rich obtain college educations and the networks and experiences that stem from them. I would be so sad if my kids, who are all under 10, or their kids, only have the option to choose very narrow routes.
Yes, look, I totally agree with that. And it was a mistake on my part anyway last week, not to mention my two thoughts about college education in a really personal and subjective way. And if my kids are listening to this podcast, which they're not, I will deny that I ever said this. Number one, you don't go to college to get A's. You just don't. That's item number one. And item number two, and related, is you go to college to learn how to live and to be a damn grown-up.
I think we're at a place where we're moving quickly to a place where only the very rich can obtain college educations and the networks and experiences that may stem from them. I think that's a really, the network thing that you bring up is really important, because if you look at the value of a network from an Ivy, whether or not you deserve to be there, whether or not there is fair opportunity for everybody to get into that school, like there are some, I think the reason the education conversation strikes such a nerve is because it is structural, it's societal, it points to inequality on so many levels. And so, yeah, when we have a hypothetical conversation or an intellectual conversation about whether a four-year college system works for everyone, it's just a part of the conversation about whether the American economy works for everyone and how absolutely, to your, you know, to your point, Lindy, any fixes also have to work for everyone and can't make it any more exclusionary than it already is, which is frankly quite a lot.
Yeah, totally agree. Warren Yang sent us a voicemail. Voice memo, I guess, is what they are. Reminds us how cultural expectations can affect decisions on career choices and even what you study. Here you go.
A very middle-class Chinese way of looking at university is that, one, education is always the key to a better life, and two, you better major in something where you can support yourself afterwards. For pretty much all the American-born Chinese I grew up around, including myself, college was expected. And on top of that, we were to be majoring in something that had a higher potential for a job when we were done. On the squishier end, finance and business, on the firmer end, engineering and sciences. A key part of happiness from my parents' perspective was being able to support yourself. Your, quote, passions, unquote, came after that.
I think that's really interesting, too. See, like, we had such, Lindy's response, your response is so American, right? That, like, college is also part of the pursuit of happiness as opposed to the pursuit of a dang job, which is really, yeah. That's a really good reminder. I like that. Jay Embry works as a software engineer at a large car company in the UK. And he says when his company is looking to hire, it is about the cold, hard skills.
Hi, Kai and Molly. When hiring new developers, If we were to compare two 22-year-old applicants, one with a bachelor's degree in software engineering but no portfolio, and compare them to another 22-year-old with no degree but a portfolio of projects, as long as the code is well-structured and competent, the applicant without the degree but with a strong portfolio would more likely get hired as a well-paid junior developer. This is one way the software industry is mirroring the creative industry. Hiring good software developers is getting difficult, and being able to see the quality of any previous work is getting more and more important.
I don't know.
On a related but slightly separate note, we got a lot of email about the idea that learning to code is better than education, which I hope was not the impression that we gave, because I think that's a pretty overly simplistic interpretation. And it's important to note that a lot of computers are going to be learning how to code real soon. That's going to be a big...
Oh, good.
Really?
No, look, I'm just,
I don't know. I wouldn't learn in the age of automation.
I for one, am ready to meet my, you know, robot overlords or whatever the expression is. All right. This is the part of the program where we do the Make Me Smart question. What is something you thought you knew, but you later found out you were wrong about? Barbara Brown thought she knew something until, well, she had a dilemma about it.
I've always been a great speller. I was even the Alaska State Spelling Bee pronouncer for years. I still conduct spelling bees, including ones for adults. Yet until very recently, I spelled the word dilemma, D-I-L-E-M-N-A, like condemn or solemn. I wrote a blog post about it, and my sister Allison discovered there's a whole webpage of the dozens of people who also thought it was D-I-L-E-M-N-A. We are positive we learned our spelling in school. They must have changed the spelling after we graduated. A mystery. But I guess the consensus is that we were wrong.
W-R-O-N-G. You know. First of all, she enunciates very beautifully. Let me say that. She
beautifully. You can see she's a spelling bee pronouncer.
I know.
I love that. I love the weird gaps in the things that you learned. Also, I'm just going to say, Barbara, that's not your fault. That's like the English language. That makes no sense. It makes sense. All right. What is something you thought you knew? This is the question once more. What is something you thought you knew that you later found out you were wrong about? Email us your answer, or ideally your voice memo, at makemesmart@marketplace.org. We out.
Make Me Smart is produced by Shara Morris. Senior producer is Eve Troth. Tony Wagner is our digital producer. This week's program was engineered by Drew Jostad. Our theme music was composed by Ben Tolliday. Back from paternity leave, by the way. The kid's 9 weeks old. He's doing all right.
Oh.
Yeah. Well, the baby's a she, but Ben is a he, and he's doing all right. I don't know about the kid. Also, Daniel Ramirez. I
Not
thought the
this
need to
again.
Be clear there.
It's always important because of the emails. The executive director of On Demand is Satara Nieves, and the senior vice president and general manager is Deborah Clark. You know what? It's because I've been watching The Wire. This is my 2019 New Year's resolution, and it's really hard for me now to talk like The Wire.
You know what's funny? I have no desire to see The Wire. Also, Breaking Bad. I have no desire to see that. What can I tell
that
you?
That one's a no. That one's a no.
Oh. Well, now we know.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.